I don't think I mentioned it on the show last week, but I've had an AirPod Pro replacement experience now after my dog Apollo ate the last one. Did it make it to the show last week? Maybe it did.
I think you mentioned that he ate it, yeah.
I recall now because someone was concerned that he was going to eat the battery. I've taken the steps to correct it. So I got the good one back, like I mentioned, and then I contacted Apple Care over email to send back the other one that came on, you know, by mistake, the wrong sided one, and, you know, send it back and get a refund. And the short version was that I had a 25-minute phone call that was mostly like waiting on hold, and then a representative said, no need to send it back and we'll issue you a refund. And I was like, all right, cool. And so I put it in a drawer, and it was like, you know, if I ever lose the right one or something, then I'll have a spare, I guess. And that was it. And then 2 days later, I got an email saying that they were trying to reach me, Apple Care was, and they couldn't get a hold of me, but they need more information to process the refund. And And I had this issue too, like where I wasn't getting phone calls, and because I didn't have a missed phone call or anything, from PR people, and when I had scheduled a call before, and like I just wasn't getting phone calls. And so the reason for that, it was kind of a weird thing where I was using not the built-in iOS 13 feature to block unknown calls, because that with that you still get an alert about it after the fact, and it's like in your recent calls and everything, you just don't get a notification for it. And it would have been a recent call, so it like actually would have came through even though they weren't a contact. But it was AT&T Call Protect, which is an app that you install that uses the service Hiya, and it's like an AT&T account level service, but the app is what manages it, and the app will notify you when a call's been blocked so that you don't just not know you're getting calls. And I had the settings to be like any call that's not a contact, you know, to block it. And that was going well. Cool service. There's a free version and a paid version. Even the free version was like useful for not getting telemarketing calls. But then I had the setting on my iPhone to offload unused apps, and the AT&T Call Protect app fell into that category. So it was, you know, it was removed, and it had like a little download, you know, button next to it. And for that reason, I was no longer getting those alerts that it was blocking calls, even though it was like actively being used, you know, all the time. It hadn't launched, so it considered itself like not a very much used app. And so I was like troubleshooting, why am I not getting phone calls? Because part of what the Apple Care process was like was, we were trying to call you right now. Can you answer your phone? And I'm like, this is the number. Let's verify it together. Yeah, it's the phone number. So I'm not getting your call. And so I realized that's what it was I had to re-download the app, set it up from scratch, opt into the service again, and then opt out of the service to make it work, to get a phone call again.
So like the server end was still active.
That's right.
Like the client was effectively not there apart from the ghost of the app icon.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. So that was that. And then like what they needed to say was, hey, our mistake, we might actually need that returned AirPod, which is okay with me, but they said, you know, we don't know for sure, so we're gonna call you back in 2 days and let you know. So the saga continues there, but it aside from like,
so they haven't called you back yet?
I talked on the phone for a while, but it was just to get to the point where we're not sure one way or the other. We think we need it back now, but we don't want you to send it to us if you don't have to, so we'll find out in 2 days.
How is this so complicated?
I don't know. Like, I mean, I'm happy because I you know, was proactive and like ordered the correct side on my own after the chat support, you know, messed it up a little bit and got me the wrong side. So I'm not missing out. It's just like $90 in limbo. that you know, they're saying you'll get it back. It's just a matter of, do you also need to mail us something? Do we need to send you a label and have you mail it to us? You know, and I don't.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, so that's that. But it was the whole thing with like offloading apps and the call blocking that just really made it complicated. Because for like 10 minutes, I was emailing an Apple Care representative back and forth directly, of like, no, really, I'm waiting for your call too. This is the number, and you know, it's not coming through. So that makes sense.
I mean, yeah. Technically, iOS should probably be a bit smart about that.
Yeah.
Although, because it's like a,
it's not a built-in thing. It's kind of a
mix of... because there is the built-in call screening and SMS screening, but I presume because your carrier is AT&T, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so instead of it going through the system like API for call screening and call blocking and contact blocking,
it's like a network SIM card level.
It's just happening on the network, right? Like AT&T's just doing it, and the phone's none the wiser.
Yeah, which is pretty cool. Like, I didn't realize until a few weeks ago that that was even a thing. Until I was researching ways to block calls besides the built-in thing. And it seems like most carriers have a version of that where, you know, you got in iOS 12 or so, you got those extensions to block calls where an app like, Nomo Robo and Haya, and there are some more that you can subscribe to directly, and then they do it. But I guess, you know, through exposure, carriers make deals with those services. And so they do it on the carrier level, which is, you know, even cooler, and you manage it through the app. But if the app gets offloaded, and you know, it was really peaceful. It was like, you know, if you ever work, and you know, you work online and you're, you know, a computer, and you realize that you've had your email client turned off and you were really productive for like 2 hours, and you open your email client, it's like, oh, there's 50 emails I didn't know were coming in. It's kind of like that, but for phone calls. But
yeah, just thinking off the top of my head, there's not a way for you to like tell the phone, don't ever offload this app.
That's right. You can't pin an app per se or favorite one. And I can't imagine that app is really large in terms of storage. It's just like,
yeah, it's weird it picked that one. I guess because it does it more based on like oldest open first, and because once you set it up once, then leave it, you don't open it again.
Yeah, it does resolve the problem though of how I think of how maybe of how on my daughter's Apple Watch, if her iPhone was dead, then the Apple Watch wasn't blocking calls with the iOS 13 feature. It was coming straight through to the watch. That's a different phone number than the watch or than the phone. So maybe would need to be just like contact AT&T and say, hey, include this
number as well.
Yeah. I'm not sure that they've got an interface for including that other phone number. But it sounds like, you know, at least it's possible at a carrier level. So I'm learning a lot by my dog Apollo eating my left AirPod. Very insightful.
Yeah. Pinning is something that iOS kind of needs like system wide, really, like,
for lots of things, photos, music.
Yeah, there's so many services now which are like, you know, you download them, but then they can be lazily released as storage gets low, and you know, manage it automatically. But there are some things where you really want to stick, and in the iOS 13 beta season, when the buggy iCloud drive, new iCloud implementation was around, pinning was one of the features. So if you had important documents or you had files that you really always wanted to have, you could, you know, long press in the middle and click pin, and they would never be deleted by the system. When iCloud drive folder sharing got re-added in these latest iOS 13.4 betas, the pinning stuff is still missing in action, so that's still not there. But, you know, it's not just files. You have, obviously, the app situation that we just talked about, but music's one where music lets you have a minimum storage allowance, and then it will turn stuff to clouds as storage gets low, but you can't say, you know, this particular album, I always want you to save it, or just as soon as it's only, you know, parameter is the storage amount. So you can't say, oh, I really love these songs, please never delete these. So pinning would be something that would be welcomed, you know, in basically all of Apple's apps.
That's right. And even in the Photos app, you can favorite photos and videos. And maybe that takes some priority, but in my experience on my iPhone with having to have optimized storage turned on, I've been in a situation with low cellular network coverage, trying to play a video or load the full resolution photo from favorites to show to somebody, and it just wouldn't work. So it clearly wasn't prioritized to be local.
Yeah, it probably plays like a small factor, but it's definitely. I think the photos just relies basically on the photos you opened the most recently.
That's right. Yeah,
that's about it. And then videos, it's very aggressive in offloading if you're doing the optimized storage mode. And there, obviously, we've talked about before how it would be nice if photos had a different mode that wasn't just optimized storage and keep everything, but like keep the last month of videos and pictures on my device and offload everything else. Like, there's a lot of granularity there that iOS is a platform, and obviously that's a, you know, a Mac thing as well, because iCloud Photos works the same on the Mac. All of the iCloud stuff needs to mature in ways like that, just so you have a bit more control, because the automatic stuff doesn't quite get it right every single time.
Yeah, and maybe this pen, I mean, like you mentioned, with iCloud Drive folder sharing, that they shipped it in beta, but then they pulled it before it was released, and it's still not back yet, even in beta. And so it's clearly a lot of work to get that right. But that maybe once they release that for iCloud Drive, then they can retool it for different services too, that it could, you know, be that would get them part of the way there. It's a fun thing to think about.
A completely random aside on the photos thing that's just popped in my head, and I meant to bring this up a couple of weeks ago but forgot. Did you know that, so you know in Photos where you have like the day view and the month view where it prioritizes pictures to show you versus the All Photos view, there's like, you know, AI curation going on there, and you can kind of think of things where it's looking into like faces that are prominent and location data and event information, like it labels it with concerts and stuff based on a like an onboard concert database that it has. One of the things in the Photos like white paper they have, it actually looks into the audio of your live photos.
Oh, wow.
And if it can hear like cheering or like babies, like not crying but, you know, like laughing and stuff, it prioritizes it based on the audio as well.
That's clever. That makes
sense. I did not realize it actually analyzed the audio, but that's what their white paper says. It says, in addition to, you know, the visual stuff for live photos and I presume videos as well, we actually do audio analysis.
So way to go, live photos. That's made possible by live photos, which was from the iPhone 6S in like 2015, I think, right? So now it's got a whole new level of utility.
And the live photos are just cool in that like day view on the new iOS 13 photos, because as you scroll by, they just animate and look really nice.
Let's jump into some news this week. There's a lot of cool stuff happening in just the last couple of days to talk about. First thing, kind of minor, but it's a change to app store review guidelines for apps. Mayo, you're a developer, so what's happening there as it relates to developers, and how will customers be affected?
Yeah, so App Store review guidelines are basically the App Store rules. Even they call them guidelines because it sounds nicer, but and
they're not
and
suggestions, the real they're rules.
And the real rules are whatever Apple thinks at the time, because the guidelines are not all-inclusive, and Apple reserves the right to reject anything for any reason, really. So, but the guidelines kind of lay out the situation. And one of the clauses that has been, you know, controversial for a while is the clause about push notification marketing. And so, originally, this was worded such that using push notifications for marketing advertising was always not allowed. That's what the guidelines said. In real life, obviously, that didn't happen because that rule is essentially unenforceable, right? Like, even Apple's own apps use the push notifications for marketing because, like, yes, it can be annoying and people can spam with it, but there are genuine uses where you just want to be marketed to, quote unquote, but it's, you know, useful at the same time. And so that rule has been in the document for years and years and years, and basically just it's been like a laughing stock, right? Because no app conforms to it because it doesn't make any sense.
I think it got the most attention a few years ago, like 2015-16 timeframe, where I think for the first time the App Store sent a push notification about something, and they didn't do it again either. It was just that one time, I think. But everybody was screenshotting and sharing on Twitter the guideline that says you can't do this, and then it was like the App Store itself doing that. And like the big example that I can think of is of what's common that you see and what's frustrating as a user is that, like, say for example, Domino's Pizza, their app can say, do you want push notifications, yes or no? And you can say yes, so that maybe then you get notifications about when your order is out for delivery, when it's about to arrive. But they'll also use that same opt-in to let you know that they've got a, you know, a coupon ready for you to use, and they want you to, you know, give them some business, and it's all the same system. And within the app, you know, I think Starbucks is another version of this, where like Starbucks will have notifications for promotions, and they can be pretty aggressive. But then you can go and granularly look down, like, because Starbucks made like a whole system for this on their own of, do you want just notifications about your order, or do you want notifications for marketing? But that's not system level. That's app by app basis.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, other good examples on Apple's side is like the Apple Music app will send you notifications if you want to subscribe and get a 3-month trial during the, crisis of the iPhone XR and the iPhone XS cycle. They sent notifications like, you know, it's your time to get a new iPhone and all, the, you know, all that stuff. And obviously now you get TV Plus notifications if you don't sign up for the free year. They send you like 4 of them at different intervals to let you know that your time's running out and whatever. So, you know, Apple sends marketing as well as anybody else. So the updated rule basically now allows all that as perfectly fine, as long as there is a toggle to turn off marketing notifications. And so that scopes the rule to the point where, you know, all of Apple's apps now comply because you can turn off notifications, right? The wording of the guideline doesn't necessarily say that you have to provide separate options. So if notifications are, like, required for your app to function, like the Domino's Pizza case where you might want to get an alert to know that your pizza's done, but not all the coupon spam, right? So if you were, like, reading it directly, I think you could get away with just having one toggle, which kind of pointless, but I think what they mean is, you know, you've got to have one toggle for marketing and one toggle for other app functions. And yes, at the moment, that means every single app has to implement this all individually because there isn't, like, a system-wide, like, channels feature, which is something that the Android operating system has, where at their level, they have the concept of notifications and then the concept of, like, notification category channels on top of that. So
yeah, that's smart.
General notification settings, you can turn off on a category basis, which would be a great feature for Apple to add, because then that could also integrate with stuff like the Apple Watch, where you can say, like, I want to mirror all the notifications to my phone, but I only want these two categories to go to my watch, right? And that's basically impossible for a third-party app to do today. So hopefully some of this stuff is, like, you know, preceding iOS 14 changes, because it'd be nice if they could just have marketing toggles directly in notification settings, and then you could have the toggles for the actual application features as well.
Yeah, the state of notifications right now, too, is that they've made Control Center a few updates ago where it's much more manageable with, like, group notifications instead of just having this big, long, sprawled-out list. But then they've also done changes to allow alerts to come in without your permission if they're delivered quietly, and then you've got to turn that off. And just having quiet notifications is a cool concept, because if they did take the Android route and allow notification channels, then you could say, I want, you know, something like a coupon to be delivered quietly so that it doesn't interrupt me, but it's still on my lock screen or notification center. But then I want to have, you know, the delivery update to be invasive, right? Exactly. Yeah. So
yeah, there's a lot of granularity and cool nuance they could unlock there if they supported something like that at the system level, for sure.
Yeah. So iOS 14 feature requests, and, you know, I think on the Apple Watch, I don't think about it a whole lot, but I've seen people complain that the way that deliver quietly is handled on the watch isn't the same as on the iPhone. So I can't quite articulate what the differences there are, but I'm pretty sure that it's that you don't.
I guess the thing is, on the, because it wouldn't buzz your wrist, but as soon as you scroll down to notification center, it would be in there. Whereas if you, on the iPhone, the notification center kind of, like, has, like, two modes, right? Where you open notification center and you see recent notifications, and then you scroll up and see them all. Whereas the watch doesn't really have that extra level. Mm-hmm. It just has that, you just slide down and you're immediately seeing everything. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
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 So I guess that's what they're talking
about. Yeah, so there's some more sophistication that needs to be had there. And is there anything else with some of these changes there's some stuff now where they're going to require apps to be made for iOS 13 as of the end of April, which is no surprise. They do this each year with versions, and they're kind of leaning on the fact that more than 3 out of 4, at least iPhones are now running, that are in active use are running iOS 13. I think for the iPad, almost 8 out of 10. Yeah, it's even better. But is there anything interesting in any other changes with what they've announced today?
Yeah, so obviously they reminded people about the signing of Apple deadline, which is April 30th, 2020. And that deadline is based on the revised rule set, right? Because originally during the summer, it was much more prescriptive that you had to have a sign with Apple button and it had to be the first button in the list and all that stuff. And so now they've kind of reeled it back a little bit. So you still have to offer the option, but it doesn't have to be the primary option. It can be, like, hidden. And they've rolled it back to, I think, as a fair degree, because we talked about this at the time on the show. Like, technically, yes, signing with Apple is probably the best option that you'll have, but it's not really, like, it's probably an overreach to, like, require it to be, you know, the big button that everyone has to tap. Like, just you can't impose your own things on people just because, under the excuse of, like, privacy and safety necessarily, right? Like, otherwise you could make that same argument about literally every service and lock everyone out. So I think it's fine where the current rule set is, and that comes into effect on April 30th. And then the other new change, the other big new change they have in the guidelines here, is they updated the common app rejections list. So basically, this included this was the paragraph that included, like, we will reject you if you submit a fart app and stuff before because yeah. we just have too many of them. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, now they've extended the list to also include fortune telling apps and dating apps. Now,
pretty broad.
Yeah, fortune telling, whatever. That's probably just like spammy rubbish. But, you know, dating apps are a pretty popular category. And you see new dating apps come on the scene quite regularly. So it's kind of weird that they would put this in this, you know, frequently rejected list. Because I think it's, I don't think there's like a limit on necessarily the innovation or the different differentiation different companies could have on dating applications. Right. Because it's not like fortune telling where you can just think everyone's just, you know, rebranding RSS feeds of.
Yeah,
you know, Caprigo and Pisces. Like mm-hmm. dating apps, like a big category. And if you look on the top grossing lists, you know, Tinder and stuff like that, their subscriptions are making loads of money. They're a huge, you know, growing business, and you see new apps pop in that thing all the time. So it's kind of strange for Apple to like name them as, you know, don't make these anymore.
Yeah, I wouldn't. There must be a tier of dating apps that are not Tinder, you know, or the Match.com kind of thing, but that it's not as known, but they're just too copycat and they're just not mm-hmm. useful. And they're maybe spamming a certain category. And
yeah, you might find that Apple's receiving like 100 clones of Tinder per week that are, you know, just made by people just trying to make themselves look like Tinder, but aren't Tinder or whatever. Yeah,
ineffective so, dating apps, right?
Like, yeah, exactly. Like, and so again, right, they can write anything they want in these guidelines, they can enforce something completely different. So it is just kind of funny they named it like that, because yeah, I can understand like fortune telling being a good example, but I think there's still probably enough innovation in the dating space for them not to like be so prescriptive there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's curious.
But mainly about the push notification thing, before the rule was basically never enforced and essentially unenforceable because how broad it was. Now the rule is more scope to the point where it could be enforced. We have to wait and see whether they actually do it or not, right? Because although now the rule is more sensible, doesn't necessarily mean Apple's going to send a team of people around checking every single app to see if they've got a toggle for marketing or not. So we just have to wait and see whether how officious they are at actually enforcing it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, classic, but the fortune telling apps could see this coming. All right, let's someone else who can see what's coming is Ming-Chi Kuo. How do you like that?
That was a good segue.
And Ming-Chi Kuo of TF International Securities has released another new investor note this week. That looked at the supply chain and what's coming from Apple. And the last we discussed was a lot about the coronavirus, but then it included some, you know, also scoops too. This new one is a lot about, I guess it's, what is it, micro-LED as a display?
Mini-LED.
Mini-LED as a display type. And so that's the supply chain part. But then also, there's some big things in there. The two big things are that the 13-inch MacBook Pro will be upgraded to 14.1 inches. And so it's technically 13.3 inches now. It'll jump to 14.1 inches with the revision. And we've long wanted a 14-inch MacBook Pro. Once the 15-inch was replaced with a 16-inch, we thought, well, there you go. It's going to be a 14-inch to, you know, take that same design but scale it a little bit. That sounds like it's happening now, and this is the first time that there's actually a rumor, not just, you know, we all assume. So that's neat. And then he's really good with screen sizes and with supply chain, so it's really believable. And then that there will be a new iMac Pro in the fourth quarter of this year, which is the first time we're hearing about a new iMac Pro because the current model is like, what is it, 20...
It must have been ended 2017.
2017. So it was like, yeah, December. So it was mostly 2018, but then we've gone all of last year without a new version. There was obviously focus on the Mac Pro and getting that out the door. There was, the iMac Pro is not like a super modern design. There's plenty of room for, you know, the iMac to just have a more high end version, and that like space gray to be a thing. But according to Ming-Chi Kuo, there will be a new iMac Pro proper. And yeah, there's more than that too, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so obviously the center of the port is mini-LED, so both of those products you just mentioned would apparently be upgraded to mini-LED displays. And you'd have also a 12.9-inch iPad Pro this year with mini LED, a 10.2-inch iPad this year with mini LED, a 16-inch MacBook Pro with mini LED, and a 7.9-inch iPad Mini with mini LED. Now, the screen sizes of the iPads are all the same as what we had before, but notably does not mention the 11-inch.
And it's not the first time he's done this omission for 11-inch. Yeah,
he has definitely been less keen on the 11-inch roadmap in recent months, for sure. So maybe the 11-inch is going away. I mean, Quo's normally pretty specific, so he hasn't said Apple is no longer going to make a new 11-inch iPad Pro. He just hasn't mentioned it for a while. So there's definitely been times before where because one of the things he got wrong, or at least he was right for a long enough time, is he said he doesn't see any more iPad Minis on the horizon, and this was around like 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was kind of saying the iPad Mini was dead around 2015, and it was true until literally last year when they finally gave it a very, very minor spec bump to keep it around and gave it Apple Pencil support.
A couple of things on that is, so I was thinking about this, and we've got the rumor of the trackpad smart keyboard. So you've got to imagine that it has to be a redesign from the current smart keyboard, because there needs to be a trackpad somewhere on it, presumably below the keyboard. So then you've got a redesign of how that whole product works. Would you even bother with an 11-inch version of that, because there's an 11-inch keyboard, but is there enough room to have a trackpad as well? It gets pretty cramped in that way. So maybe they would only have it for the larger version. And then even just price-wise, like maybe it's just that's what you make it for, and there's not enough interest in the 11-inch sides. If they weren't going to do that, like I think there's definitely a difference in the 11 and 12.9-inch iPad, so that they both deserve to exist, because the sizes are so different, basically by 2 inches. I would buy a larger than 12.9-inch iPad. So if it was that 11-inch went away to make room for an even bigger one, and then you relied on the 7.9-inch iPad and the 10.2-inch iPad and the 10.5-inch iPad is like the smaller than 12.9-inch screens, and that'd be okay. Especially once you get to, no longer using, like right now there's a curious model, which is the iPad Air, what is the number, 3?
3, yeah.
Which is basically the 10.5-inch iPad Pro, but revised to be more affordable and with a modern chip. That's pretty close to the now 10.2-inch iPad in terms of screen size. There's some bezel differences and a lot of tech differences, and that's the version that replaced the 9.7-inch iPad. Notice that he also doesn't say that there will be a mini LED 10.5-inch iPad here.
He doesn't.
And he's calling out the 10.2 one, which is the budget one compared to the 10.5-inch one. So maybe just the whole thing is a little bit weird in that it will be different, or that it's just about this year. But I did find that curious, no 11 for one, but then no 10.5, which is the middle of the road model, whereas the 10.2 is like the entry level model. There's a pretty big price difference.
Whereas
there.
Like you'd think if he wasn't mentioning the 10.5, you also wouldn't mention the 10.2 and the 7.9, but those two are on the list.
Yeah. Didn't mention 21.5-inch iMac, and didn't mention the non-pro iMac as having this display.
Yeah, he didn't mention any iMacs.
Yeah, just the pro.
I can definitely see, because the iPad Pros got significantly more expensive with the 2018 model, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember when I bought mine 2015 iPad Pro, which I still have and still use, which was 32GB, the 12.9-inch, that was $799. And now the baseline 12.9-inch iPad is $999. Yeah, you get 64GB storage, not 32, but still, it's $999. So I could definitely see them keeping the 11 around to bring the price point down, because the 11 is $799 today.
Yeah.
And so if they could bring it down to $699, that's more reasonable, right?
And so by not updating it at all, it's just that bit cheaper?
Yeah, just keep it in the line, but push the price down a bit, right? Mm-hmm. And it would still be differentiated enough from the 10.5, because it's different design, to stick around, and maybe the 10.5 goes away, maybe it doesn't. Depends on whether, like, it's not clear to me what the price of the mini LED displays is, right?
Yeah,
could you expect them to be more expensive? But if they're going to put them into the iPad Mini, then it seems less. It lines up less.
Well, the Mini isn't cheap though, because it costs more than the 10.2-inch. The 10.2-inch is the one that you'd say that's the price conscious one.
It's the second cheapest, right? The Mini, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so 10.2 is 329, the mini is 399, right? So both of the cheapest iPad models are getting the new screen technology. So it kind of implies it isn't going to be as expensive thing. And it's important to remember that mini LED is not micro LED, right? Micro LED is the really advanced one that
Yes.
Yeah, so micro LED is the one that is Apple supposedly, you know, growing in a lab in that secret San Francisco thing that we talked about a few months ago. And that's not destined till like 2023. And that's the one that we think Apple's going to do for the Apple Watch, right? The micro LED displays to replace the OLED in that. Mini LED is like somewhere between micro and normal. It's like, it's more around the backlighting technology than anything else.
Yeah. What, how does, and also, how does it compare to OLED, which the O is, I think, organic, right? So
yeah. So micro LED is like the direct replacement for OLED.
Okay. Micro LED, so the new thing that they're making is...
Yeah, so the new thing they're working on, which at the moment is really expensive to do in any screen size bigger than like half an inch. And so that's why the first target would be the Apple Watch, because that's only 1.5 inches. So it's, you know, it's within the current development stretch, right? For a couple of years away. The mini LED stuff, and the micro LED is where each individual pixel individually lights itself, which is what OLED does as well, right? Each individual OLED pixel is individually lit, which is why you get the great contrast ratios, because each individual pixel can turn itself on and off to be black or not. And that's what micro LED can do. Mini LED is kind of like what they have in the Pro Display XDR, where they kind of have like the dimming zones, right? So it's not every single pixel can turn itself on and off, but you've kind of got like however many divisible boxes of screen and backlight that can turn itself on and off.
So it's a compromise in cost and quality, but it's better than just LED.
Yeah, because you're basically going to get better contrast, because you're getting contrast per region, right?
Because LED is LED backlit LCD, so it's still LCD. And the
current LCD backlits that we have today is just one big thing that can be on and off together, right? So you can't dim by zone, which is what they did in the Pro Display XDR, and what will mini LED allow for as well. It's only micro LED and OLED where each individual pixel can turn itself on and off, which is where you're getting the true, you know, the true contrast difference.
Yeah, much better, amazingly different contrast ratios, and you don't see, you know, with LCD and then even LED backlit LCD, you know, even on the iPad, especially on the Mac. Like, I love the 16-inch MacBook Pro, but it's clearly not a perfect display in terms of how the backlighting is, because you can, you know, if you're on a dark image or a dark website, and especially if the brightness is higher up, you can see in the back, like, where that light is, you know, where the source of light is.
Yeah, and everyone wants to do micro, not OLED, because OLEDs have the burnout problem, micro LEDs won't, at least that's what they think when they can finally manufacture in big enough quantities. And micro LED has opportunities to be thinner and less, more power efficient and stuff. So that's why everyone's looking into micro LED to replace OLED. And then so basically, if you're looking at a pecking order, it would be LCD, LED backlit LCD, mini LED, OLED, micro LED, right? So micro LED is the best, but it's basically unfeasible to make at the moment. OLED is good, but it's still kind of expensive for bigger screens, which is why it's only currently in the phones, and it has the problems of burn-in and weird off-angle color shift and stuff like that. We are sponsored this week by Samebox, the easiest way to get your email under control and hit that magic inbox zero. If email is an overwhelming mess for you, like it is for so many people, Samebox is the tool you need to use. Samebox takes advantage of artificial intelligence to monitor your inbox, making sure you see important emails and aren't distracted by the rest. As messages hit your inbox, Samebox does the triage. Important emails stay in your inbox and everything else is put into your Same Later folder for you to peruse at your convenience. It makes it super easy to separate the email that you need to immediately pay attention to and what stuff you can get to later on your own terms. Even better, you don't need to use a special app or any kind of weird plugin to use the Samebox service. One of the best features of Samebox is the black hole. Do you have annoying senders who email you day in and day out and you just don't want them to? Maybe it's a brand that refuses to stop messaging you, no matter how many times you click that unsubscribe button. Well, just drag messages to the same black hole folder and you'll never have to hear from that sender again. Done. On the other hand, let's say you've sent a message to someone and you need to keep tabs if they've replied or not. The same reminders feature will watch to see if they reply on your behalf, and if they don't by a date that you specify, it alerts you so that you can be aware that they are dragging their feet and lets you naturally follow up with them. Sendbox works with every single email server or service that has ever been created. There's nothing to learn and nothing to install. See it for yourself by visiting sendbox.com/9to5Mac, where you can get a 2-week free trial and a $25 credit. That's sendbox.com/9to5Mac. sanebox.com/9to5Mac. sanebox.com/9to5Mac. Our thanks to Sanebox for their support of Happy Hour.
So we've got the 10.5-inch iPad, the 11-inch iPad, and the rumored 14-inch MacBook Pro that is rumored because of this report. He doesn't make that clear that it will have this new display type, but the 16-inch will have it first, and then all the non-Pro iMacs. So,
and it was kind of interesting because we've heard, again, we generally put Quo at the top of the pile, right, in terms of respectability. Yes. There have been some contradicting reports that the 13-inch MacBook Pro would be upgraded in the spring and would not have the screen size change, right?
Right. So
maybe there's two, which seems unlikely, but there could be two MacBook Pros, or the other ones were just wrong and he's actually getting a bigger screen.
Yeah.
And that going from 13.3 to 14.1 would be exactly repeat of the playbook of the 16-inch MacBook Pro, where they just slim the bezels down slightly and you get slightly extra screen space in the same body.
Yeah, the body is a little bit bigger, but not by much. And presumably, this is also the version that takes the touch bar and gives you the physical escape key, gives you touch ID. Well, touch ID is already separate, but gives you. Well, no, it is separated. And then
yeah, separate. Yeah, literally separate.
Yeah, you get the keyboard that you can recommend that people buy without it flicking out, and you get the inverted T arrow keys. The biggest thing is the keyboard reliability. it's so nice to have that now. But yeah, presumably 14-inch, you know, you also get those things too, not just a different screen size. And I love the idea of clarity in the lineup of having the MacBook Air be the 13-inch model and the MacBook Pro being a little bit bigger. You know, it's just that much different.
Yeah, I'd agree with you there.
Yep. And then it isn't just Quo predicting things. Our good friend Coin on Twitter, often as CoinX on Twitter. Coin with eight eyes or Coin 10, CoinX. They have a new prediction, actually two new predictions. The thing with Coin is that Coin has tweeted out some very specific proven true spec details, even things like how many holes will the bottom of this iPhone XS have on either
the
side.
The thickness of the model, like to the millimeter.
Exactly. Like specs that are probably on a spec sheet somewhere, you know, or on a photo. So they say iMac and Mac Mini, new iMac and Mac Mini coming soon emoji. So that's the first we've heard that. Notice that wasn't in Quo, in Quo's report, anything about the iMac non-Pro because it won't get the mini LED. So, okay. But Coin believes they're coming, which makes sense for like a spring quiet refresh. And then the Mac Mini. This would be the first new Mac Mini since the Mac Mini was revived from near death with what was like the 2012 model, 2014 model.
It was 2014, then it was 2018.
Then it's 2018. So, you know, 2 years on that is okay. And then, you know, presumably it's just a spec bump and not like a big overhaul of that. And that isn't the only thing Coin says. He also says the iPad Pro camera upgrade, just references that as a thing, is really good. His 100 emoji, I believe he said.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
I think everyone's been thinking at this point because everyone's talking about the new camera system on the iPad Pro, presumably coming in a spring update, and then there might also be an iPad in the fall with 5G, and the camera looks like the iPhone 11 camera system, but one of the lenses is the true depth camera 3D sensing stuff,
which we have
as yet unknown benefits.
Unknown benefits. The camera is an interesting thing because that could be what forces compatibility to not Like your 2018 iPad Pro did not work with the 2020 iPad Pro accessories, like the trackpad, if it wraps around that camera and the camera bump is like the thing that, because that happens all the time with iPhone cases, you know, battery cases, that it's the camera cutout that makes the difference. And on the iPhone, we care about the camera. On the iPad, it's up in the air if a camera is of importance to you or not. For me, it's much lower than any other thing about the iPad. And so if that's what breaks compatibility with, like, you know, my iPad, although maybe like because the camera cutout is just bigger, that they, if they were generous in the design, they could make something work because you just have extra space, isn't like going the other direction. But they've not done that on the iPhones where they make them compatible when the camera changes.
So obviously CoinX doesn't specify exactly what would be different in the new iMac and Mac Mini. I would expect the Mac Mini's just spec bump. I would hope that the iMac is more radical, because we've already been through 1 year of having a pretty unradical iMac update, because we had the same complaints last year when they did a spring iMac refresh that was very minimal. It'd be annoying if we had to go through that whole palaver again.
Your iMac theory is that they could do a redesign in the consumer iMac and not do that on the Pro iMac, because the Pro iMac can't fit into certain constraints that the consumer iMac could. And technically, the Pro iMac is what has been redesigned internally to be a Pro iMac, whole new fan system and everything. I think the opposite of that would be that they do a new design in the Pro model because it costs more, and they could, you know, flex a little bit there, I guess. But then you've got the argument of, well, what constraints would that be? And there's clearly room for them to do something in the consumer end too. They have done
the consumer iMac with the internal redesign of the Pro.
Mm-hmm.
Because now it's 2 years old, presumably it's cheaper to make.
Sure.
They can fit same components in. And
drop hard disk and do all.
Yeah, that's the main thing. Yeah. They need to add the T2 chip and get rid of the spinning hard drives. Because none of the iMacs, even if you get the solid state options today, come with a T2 chip.
Yep. And what's the LG 4K display? It went from 21.5 inches to 24?
It's
23.
Yeah. And they made the resolution worse.
Worse, yeah. It's not technically retina, I guess, unless sit further back.
I sure hope they don't use that panel.
So, that's what I was going to say, is I wonder if that's what happens to the consumer iMac, but it's the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, that'd be... If they can go to 23 inches and, you know, boost the resolution up to keep the PPI the same, that'd be fine, but don't do what they did with the ultrafines.
Mm.
Apple, I hope Apple knows that the model to follow is not what LG does.
Yeah. they're the display supplier, right? So they're cutting the panel.
Yeah. But. So iMac, I 100% believe it is time for them to do a design update. The chin is annoying. The bezels are pretty thick. Whether they're going to do one or not, it doesn't seem like it, because we haven't heard anything else about it, and it'd be a pretty radical update. But internally, man, if they release another iMac generation and it still doesn't go all solid state, that is going to be... I will not be happy.
You will continue to not buy it.
I will continue to not buy it. Continue to complain about it. Yeah. You take that up.
Yeah. I think your assessment is right, that because there's no smoke here to a fire, that there's, it's not going to happen, that we probably hear about it.
Kind of insane that Quo is predicting 6 product updates this year. Like, and that's just the product updates with mini LEDs. We'd also expect, obviously, the new phones, the iPad, the MacBook Air with a new keyboard update. Like, that's quite a lot of items for them to refresh.
Yeah, and now we're in March, and there hasn't been anything yet, you know. So they could do spring, they could do summer, they could do, you know, end of fall and have different periods of releases. But, you know, and I think the big thing here, too, is that behind all of this production stuff is how does the coronavirus COVID-19 affect production? And with iPhone, it's such a huge scale that it's a concern. But with Macs, I imagine it's not that it's low volume enough that, you know, they'll stick to the roadmap, that it's not a big deal.
And if they have to bump it a few months down the line, then so be it.
Yeah, Macs are not stuck to its schedule in the fall.
And the iPhone affects their fundamental business dramatically.
Yeah.
It's priority number one. you can imagine when all this coronavirus stuff coming on, all the people in China working at Foxconn and all the other factories, it's like, how do we make sure the iPhone's on track? Like, the 14.1 inch MacBook Pro Air, whatever, if we have to push it to September, then there we go, right?
Yeah. Like, and speaking of Coin, like, I know you tweeted, but that whenever he had his two tweets today, or they had their two tweets today, and then we gave them coverage, there were some people in his Twitter mentions, or their Twitter mentions, that were like, but you got the last thing wrong. But that was so minor. What was it?
Right. So so he's got everything right, including incredibly like details about the weights of the products, how many holes he predicted, the asymmetric holes on the iPhone XS, where you have four holes on the left hand side of the Lightning connector and six holes on the right. He had the thicknesses, he had the weights, he had everything right. And he was on a complete roll. He must have done like 10 tweets of that nature. He had the names of the iPhone XR and XS and stuff. Well, that was still
first
up in the air.
Yep.
First, yeah, all of that. That's how we found him, right? Because we searched it afterwards and we found this account tweeting about it.
That's right.
That's where it came from. And so all of this fantastic track record. Okay, so it comes around to September 2019, just before the iPhone event for the iPhone 11 Pro. And he tweets, quote, "And here's one more thing," end quote. Obviously implying that the keynote event would have a section for a one more thing product. And at that time, there were, you know, the rumors about the AirTags were very prevalent. There were rumors about the 16-inch MacBook Pro. The event came. The event ended. There was no special product announcement. There was no one more thing said, mentioned at all. So yes, he was wrong, right? Okay. So he got the last one wrong. But he or she, we don't know, right, to be honest. It could be anyone. They received incredible amounts of, like, online flaming for that. Like, it's this anonymous account sharing these details that has had an incredible record, right? You have one mistake. He got absolutely... You can just go back and click on that tweet. Every single person is like, how dare you tweet this? It's unacceptable. What are you doing with your life?
Yeah, I kind of like 25 and I was done. It was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's like ridiculous. And he got the same thing again today when he's tweeted this stuff again after 4 months of being away. Mm-hmm. Right? We talk about plenty of rumors on this website that have way lower accuracy ratings than 10 out of 11. Okay? It's not like some vague prediction of, he's literally talking about products that no one else had mentioned, right? He's talking about an iMac and a Mac Mini soon, okay? You know, we love Quo. Quo is great. Minchi Quo is great. He's not 100%, but that doesn't mean we, you know, deride him for all that he's worth, right?
And like, some stuff's too small for Quo to be on his radar.
Yeah. And if I had the accuracy of Quo with a D, I'd be like, over the moon, right? I'd be so happy. It'd be better than Mark Gurman. Like, that's just the reality, right? Like, Quo's accuracy rating is really, really good. CoinX's accuracy has been really, really good, apart from one. And people are like, how dare you do this to me? I don't trust you ever again. Like, come on, there's some random Apple employee risking his career to, like, tweet this stuff, and you can't even give him a pass on one thing? Like, give the person a break.
Yeah, I on Twitter I invited CoinX on the podcast, and so CoinX, if you're listening, I will protect your voice.
You can completely destroy your anonymity. For...
I will protect your voice. Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about the Coin Twitter account too is that clearly, so we know what Quo does. Quo is a supply chain analyst. Quo has sources in manufacturing, and so you literally see what's happening, and you make the assessment, and you let your investor clients know this is what's going on. This is where to invest your money. Mark Gurman has sources within Apple who talk about what they're working on. That's his reporting style. Coin seems to have something to do with, like, maybe marketing of the website. I don't know, but there's things that are so specific that they must be in, like, you know, spec sheets or marketing material or like the
or in product design itself.
Could be in product design itself. Mm. And then usually time pretty late. So that's what makes me think, like, website, you know, like marketing stuff, mm-hmm. once you're preparing all that stuff. Cause, you know, as we've seen in previous cycles, the iPhone stuff goes online before it's ready before the event, you know. Yeah. So maybe listen to that. But and so if you think about that, then how would they know about a one more thing in an event? And also that event was like 20 minutes shorter than it should have than the normal 2 hour event. It was like 1 hour 40, and there was definitely like room for, you know, if not one more thing, something else.
And, yeah, like if you actually go back and watch that event, the pacing is such that you're so pumped, and then they end with like this retail update that, you know, retail's fine and it's nice and everything, but it's generally not how Apple structures their keynotes to like end on like a whimper.
Retail tends like, to be like where you build up.
It was perfectly built up to have some surprise at the end, and it didn't have it, which heavily suggests that it got cut out. So maybe somehow, however, CoinEx saw the original script, it did have the one more thing reference in it, and it got dropped at the last minute. But
right.
Yeah,
which is not surprising, like that happened. So we are still fans of both Quo and Coin, and
CoinEx is much more than a coin flip on reliability.
Yes, like, it's not 50-50.
You know, if he went the whole year and he didn't tweet something good again, fine, then you can like ignore him.
Yeah,
or whatever,
Coin got canned or Coin got scared.
Yeah, like one, you know, one thing that has some seeds of truth in it, even if it didn't happen. Like, chill out.
Yep. So. All right. Speaking of the coronavirus a moment ago with COVID-19, there's a great attention this week on whether or not Apple will hold the Worldwide Developer Conference in June in San Jose at all, because many, many, many conferences that have been announced have been canceled, or that would have been announced have been announced to be canceled before they were ever announced. There's one exception of a mass gathering in Austin, South by Southwest Festival, which is multi-week event. They still insist on having South by Southwest, because the city's idea is that people will still come even if they cancel it, which maybe, but I think that there are a lot of people who won't. And my theory is that they're waiting to be forced to cancel it by some higher power than the city, so that they can request, you know, lost revenue later on.
Insurance reasons.
Exactly. Yeah. But for WWDC, there's not that concern for Apple. You know, a $1,600 ticket is money, but it's not their business. They don't have a concern about a city's revenue like Austin does, because they went from San Francisco to San Jose.
The deposit on the building is not going to worry them.
That's right. And the more we think about it, you know, the less essential having an in-person keynote is, because a very small percentage of people involved get to be at the keynote and be at the conference for that week. It's such an exorbitant amount of money to attend, not because of just the $1,600 fee, but time from work and traveling there from around the country
hotels
or around
really
the world.
Expensive.
Exactly. So hotels are the biggest cost. So it's a luxury to attend WWDC. So to not have one for a year is not the end of the world in terms of developer reach. And then Apple is the technology company. They have the technology to, you know, hold a virtual conference if they wanted to, or to, you know, give out the same information in some other way, which wouldn't change how a lot of people interact with WWDC to begin with.
Yeah, like the big thing that kind of like triggered me into thinking, yeah, WWDC's not going to happen this year, is that Google I/O got cancelled, and that's basically the exact same thing, only like 3 weeks before, right? 5,000 people coming to a Google conference in San Francisco, and it happens in like the middle of May, and WWDC's the first or second week of June, right? So if Google I/O is getting cancelled, I highly doubt Apple's going to risk putting on WWDC.
Yeah, when Facebook...
You don't want to be the company that like makes the coronavirus spread over Silicon Valley, right? Do you know what I mean? Like,
that's
the
right.
PR alone is like terrible. Plus, you have the health concerns and the risks, and you have all your employees there who have very, you know, important jobs to do over the rest of the summer, like getting all the operating systems ready for September, all of this stuff, right? It just seems an incredible, like...
It's high risk, low reward.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, the community puts WWDC on this pedestal because, you know, frankly, a lot of the community that's podcast is privileged enough to be able to go, right? And they have their own events and they
impress,
get to,
yeah,
you know, meet with all their friends, and you have all the press, you know, the private press briefings and stuff, right? Like, but when you think about it at a more macro level, WWDC hosts 5,000 people, right? there are, what, 15, 20 million registered Apple developers. Most developers working on Apple apps for Apple platforms do not attend WWDC. I have never attended WWDC, not because I don't want to, just because it's so expensive and it's a massive journey for me to come from Britain. And I'd have to, like, you know, not do my regular job for a week or more, but an outlay incredible amounts of money to sort it out. And I'm also an Apple developer, and I develop apps every single year on the latest releases, on the latest OSs, on all the betas, just fine without attending in person. You can do it. Yes, it kind of is not quite as nice that you can't have the labs where you have nice little hands-on and one-to-one chats with framework engineers, but you can get by. Apple already puts every single session on video. Most of them are live-streamed last year. I'm sure they'll do even more live-streaming this year. And if you look further into history, Apple has done this thing called Tech Talks, which are basically mini one-day conferences in like 20 different countries at random times in the year. They did one for when iOS 7 came out, so that was 2013. They had WWDC in June, and then in like November, they held Tech Talks, which were, you know, one day lessons, one day things, seminars, whatever you want to call them, in London, in China, in Italy, in America, in Canada, like 20 different countries.
It's like WWDC, but worldwide.
Yeah, and it'd just be like a one-day thing where they only talked about how to optimize your app to be flat and not skeuomorphic, how to design your apps, how to take advantage of new APIs. And then they did the same thing again in 2016. And so that time it was about the Apple TV. So they held, you know, 20 different little one-day conferences just for the Apple TV operating system, because the Apple TV was announced in September, so it missed WWDC that year, right? And it came out in November. So they obviously thought they needed to have some presence in real life to talk to engineers. And they, you know, happily hosted things then. They could do the exact same thing this year if they felt it was needed to. And if they don't want to do that, they can just up the online presence of WWDC. You could even have webinars and, you know, one-to-one chats online and tickets. And even if you just said, all the developers that were meant to be making these like fancy presentations and doing these sessions, just take those 2 days and write some really nice documentation and just submit that online instead. You know, like, there's perfectly good alternative situations that help and benefit the entire Apple community, not just the 5,000 people that go to San Jose every year. Right? I think it's perfectly fine. And I've seen some people like, how is Apple going to possibly start a new platform transition to ARM on the Mac without WWDC? It's like, come on, they can do it whenever they want, right? Like, the impact of talking to 5,000 people in person is very, very small in the scheme of things. They could happily cancel WWDC in June. In fact, you can't cancel it if you haven't announced it. So technically, they're not canceling anything. But they could just not do WWDC in June and then announce it online, have all the sessions, have all the information, do plenty of videos and tutorials, and then, you know, in September, in October, they can hold Tech Talks like they've done before, and it would be basically the same result at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am.
And in terms of the keynote event, they could invite US press only, invite worldwide press if they want to, if they think that's fine, or they could just like host it in the Cedar Dogs Theater and just invite like local retail employees from nearby Apple stores to fill out the crowd. And that's your keynote day. Because yeah, they'll want to have a stage presence for announcing iOS 14 and macOS 10.16 and all of that stuff, right? But They can just do that in Steve Jobs Theater with a nice, pretty event.
The thing that got us thinking about this, you know, even at the beginning of the week, is that last year it was March 14th, I believe, that they announced the date for WWDC, and that was a Thursday that I think falls on the 12th this year.
Yeah, it's leap year. Be the 12th if they did the same as last year.
Yeah, because of the extra date in February this year. And so, you know, that means that we'd be just days away from them announcing. And so they've clearly had to think, you know, they've been planning it. They obviously plan it far ahead of the June date. And so, you know, we said this on the show before, but I think it's risky to announce something in March in this climate, because you don't know how COVID-19 will be in June, worse or much better. And then it's way worse to announce something that you may have to cancel ultimately. Much better just to make alternative plans and stick with those from the beginning. And a point that you've had this week too is that they have announced dates later, like in April. So they could say, let's see what it looks like and only even announce this thing and begin registration closer to the date. that that's possible too.
Yeah, like the latest they've ever announced WWDC was April 28th, and that was in 2010.
Hmm.
And so that was a decade ago, but, you know, it's a data point. And then more recently, in 2016, so the year before they switched from San Francisco to San Jose, they did it on April the 18th. So basically the middle of April instead of the middle of March.
And that doesn't mean that WWDC was held later either. It was just, there was just less time between registration and attendance. And you know, something else they could obviously do is hold it in June. If they bought time and they thought that there would be a wholly different environment. I think the only thing is that, you know, you've got summertime and proving, you know, how germs are spreading with warmer air. And there is this concern that COVID-19 really shows itself in once the fall returns. So they could play with that, but that's just less efficient too. You've got less time with the new stuff before it comes out. If you're the technology company, why not just use your technology to put on nearly the same event you do each year?
From a purely like inhumane perspective, when you've got every other company canceling your event.
Yeah.
You don't want to be the one to stick your neck out.
I mean, South by Southwest stands out right now as being stubborn for not canceling. And that's why I've been to South by Southwest.
Like, people are almost mad at it for not canceling.
That's right. You know, and in retrospect, like, I'm not sure CS was a good idea. but it's much, much more of a concern now that COVID-19 is in the U.S. and multiple states and there are deaths. So, and Apple has a presence on South by Southwest too, which is all about TV Plus content. 2 years ago, they were at South by Southwest. It was an Eddie Q interview to talk about services and things, but it was the day that they acquired Texture, which mm-hmm. became News Plus a year later. But it was also like, you know, how does Apple handle censoring and you know, being a content provider and things like that?
Yeah, because the Apple original video content had just started up then. They'd like just signed off on buying
a new show and things like that. First time I remember hearing that TV Plus was going to be about telling great stories. It was an Eddie Q line in that interview.
Yep.
So then nothing last year. And then this year they come back to South by Southwest specifically for TV Plus content. Just because it's a film festival as much as it is anything else, and so
They're screening Home, which is their like documentary on fancy houses.
My favorite,
the Beastie Boys story, and Central Park, which is the animated musical comedy thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah,
so that's what they announced they were going to show.
Yeah, and so in doing my due diligence as a member of the press, I have asked Apple if they're still going to participate in South by Southwest, even if it's not canceled, because so many other participants have pulled out despite the festival still being held.
And they definitely replied to you, didn't they?
And in sticking to your tradition, you know, with hit or miss responses, this has been a miss. So I'm still, you know. We'll see who gets back to me first, Coin or Apple's PR department. But but that's just for TV Plus stuff, so it's not a huge deal.
Okay, so late on Wednesday night, Apple told Variety that they were no longer participating in the South by Southwest Festival, which means the premieres of their Apple TV Plus shows are not going ahead. They haven't released more information about whether they are doing alternative premieres or anything like that at this time. But that is the situation. Apple is out of South by Southwest, and we're still waiting for the WWDC news. Back to the show.
Speaking of TV Plus, there's some stuff that's happening anyway this month with TV Plus, besides like private premieres. So The Banker had his public debut in Memphis, Tennessee this week in I believe a Civil Rights Museum, which is a really cool venue to show the film, and not terribly far from where I live, maybe about 8 hours. So that's neat. And it has this Friday, right, is the theatrical release of The Banker in, the, what do they say, like select markets, limited theaters. It's really sparse in terms of where you can go in the U.S. to watch The Banker.
There's like a total like four theater chains in America.
Yeah, most of which have two theaters or at most like 10 theaters. So it's, or, you know, there's a couple of dozen theaters that are going to show it. And this is just so that they can be eligible for awards. You know, they're doing an honest effort of debuting it in theaters, but it's not your traditional theatrical release where you can just go to your movie theater and watch the movie. Most won't carry it.
I think they're working up to that. Like some of their forthcoming films, I believe the current plan is to do like a proper theatrical release, like, you know, countrywide at least. But The Banker is not it.
Yeah, Banker is not it. And it will debut on Apple TV Plus on the 20th. So what is that, 2 weeks later?
Yes.
So that's when people can actually watch it. And then, and so that's this Friday for the theatrical release. If you're in, I guess, some major markets, you're finding more markets that have more chains that are showing the movie. And I, still nothing near me. And I'll be doing some traveling. So like maybe I'll end up near it, but it doesn't look promising.
It does seem to be mostly in like the Hollywood area.
Yeah. They've got Hollywood and they've got Miami. Maybe New York, but you know, so it's some different markets. I saw Michigan was one that you'd found. So I'm going to try to seek it out before the 20th just to see the Apple TV Plus movie in theaters, but, I'm not going to, you know, fly across the country to see it. Especially when it'll be on, video in 2 weeks. And then Amazing Stories will be out this Friday. Is that right?
Correct.
And that's the new series on TV Plus that is produced by Steven Spielberg. I think it was the very first show that they revealed at the March event I attended last year.
Because they dimmed the lights and then Spielberg was in the center of the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously behind the scenes, there were some production turmoils on that one, which is why because we saw reports where it was meant to be part of the launch in November, but they, you know, switched over showrunners and there were a bit of to and fro in there. And the original series order was reported to be 10 episodes, and what they're releasing on Friday is only 5, and they haven't mentioned the other 5. So, you know, you can see some of the backhand ramifications playing out in the real world, and they're obviously just a bit late, right? And they'll probably follow up with 5 more stories later in the year or something.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it should be cool. I like sci-fi stuff. So
yeah, and there were some early reviews that came out this week and disappeared.
Yeah, it's a bit weird. There were like positive reviews from these like random websites. It wasn't like big sites like, you know, Variety and Hollywood Reporter and stuff. It was weird like comic book websites that posted scathing reviews of the first episode because apparently Apple only screened them the first episode, and then they deleted the post, so I'm not really sure what's going on there. I hope Apple has actually screened more episodes, because they had the same problem with The Morning Show and a lot of their other shows at launch, is that they only released like 2 or 3 of the episodes and they weren't as good. And then, you know, critics ended up liking it down the road when they saw the whole season, but by then the reviews had already been written and, you know, the reputation was already scarred. So especially with like an anthology series like Amazing Stories, where every episode literally is completely different, it seems pretty dumb to me that if you'd only give one episode to look at when there's 5 episodes in total and they're all completely separate and they're all coming out on the same day. So it doesn't really make sense from an embargo perspective either, but hopefully that's not the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Friday, you get to check out Amazing Stories. This is one, you know, I watched the original set of shows because it was so easy just to watch everything on TV Plus in the beginning. I've been less keen to do that on some middle shows. This is one that just interests me, and just from the trailer and the way it looks entertaining, so hopefully it's good. You know, at least visually it looks neat, so I'll watch it, you know, when there's time. Yeah. So and we'll see how that goes. Anything else for this week?
I think that's good.
All right, that is Happy Hour for this week. You can follow me on Twitter at @ApolloZach, and you can read my space news coverage at spaceexplorer.com. I'm having a blast covering space news. This Friday, I'm
blasting
I'll be
off.
This Friday, I'll be attending my second ever rocket launch, which is the first one I went to in December was a SpaceX rocket launch. Kennedy Space Center in the daytime, and I was just amazed at the experience. This time it's at midnight, so it's going to be a night launch, and I'll be viewing it from a boat, and I'll be able to see one of the things that SpaceX does when they launch a rocket is that parts of it come back down and land and they're reused, and so I'll be on the water close to where those things land. So I'm hoping that if it doesn't get weather delayed or canceled, that I'll get to see that. And I'll, of course, share what I see on spaceexplorer.com. And Mayo, you are on Twitter at
BZAMayo.
And you blog at BZAMayo.com. Is that your blog website?
Yeah,
nice.
I got the name synced up finally.
Yeah, once the Mayo Clinic realizes they don't need mayoblog.com, you can get that. Yep, awesome. And with that, we'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.